There is an ancient Chinese story about a Chinese butcher who had a cleaver that he never sharpened in 20 years. And he was asked one day what his secret might be. He said, "Well, I have noticed that there is a space between the bones of the animals, and this space is needed for the joints to move. And I always apply my cleaver in that space, and that is how I lay aside the bones, and I never have to sharpen my cleaver." The story is really told by one who popularized the message of Lao Tzu, the Chinese father of Tao. It is really a message of grace, and it came upon the earth in a different way through Jesus Christ. At the time that Jesus appeared, the world was really no better off than we are today. Its problems were under different names, but essentially, man was lost. Man did not know where to go to find the truth. Man was either enslaved to powers outside of himself, or to persons, or to his own ignorance. And the situation was so grave that it was necessary at that moment in history, just as the sun must shine and the rain must fall, at that moment there had to be a shower of words, of divine intelligence, a light. And this light that came spoke to men who had no ears and no eyes. It gave them words, and these words fell upon stony ground, upon places that could not produce the fruit of the seed of the intelligence that had shined from on high. But fortunately, the words were preserved. And though there may have been changes, alterations, the essence of that message is very vibrant today, waiting for all who can absorb it and are willing to pay the price of following it. It has been called the greatest message ever delivered to the human race, the Sermon on the Mount. And it does some very unusual things. It presents a completely new God. It erases all primitive notions about God. It also presents a completely new man. It erases all primitive notions about who man of earth is. It gives him an opportunity to stop stumbling, to stop paying a tithe to the ignorance of the world around him, and to find out that he is really a self-sufficient individual. Now, it may come as a shock to all of us to learn that although we have pretended even to ourselves that we understood the message of the man, that we could run right down those Beatitudes and say, "Well, of course I understand them," one day it comes to us and says, "Well, you understand them, but do you really? Are you living them? Was it just something you read one day? Or did it change your life? Did it bring forth the immortal creature where the mortal once stood? What have you really done about those Beatitudes?" One woman called the other day. She asked for help about her hands. And then she says, "What can I also do to help myself while you're working on this?" And I suggested she might work with the Lord's Prayer more carefully. And she said, "Well, then I'm on the right track because I say the Lord's Prayer every morning. Her emphasis was on, I say the Lord's Prayer every morning. I didn't bother at the moment to tell her that she could say it forever with no result whatsoever, because the saying of it, or the saying of the Beatitudes, is like reading the menu in a restaurant. You're still going to be hungry if that's as far as you go. Now, when I looked at these Beatitudes again, I was startled too, because I know that although I see what they mean, they are still not bone of my bone. They are not flesh of my flesh, and they must be. And then came an interesting illumination about them. And so I ask you now, what is it that you lack in this world? Make a list. Perhaps you're poor in health. Perhaps you're poor in finances. Perhaps you're poor in customers or clients or companionship. Perhaps you're poor in many things, in understanding, in justice, in friends, in possessions. And you can begin to see that as you expand the various degrees of poverty you think you have, you may come up with a list of 50 different items, some material things, some emotional, some sociological, some economic. And there you'll say, there, I'm poor in all of these things. And along comes the master and says, that's right. According to your naked eyes, you are poor in all of these things. And if you want to spend 50 more lifetimes, you still will be poor in those things, or you will change your list to another list and be poor in 50 other things, if you keep going about it the way you have been going about it. And then he revealed the great new higher dimension. Nobody is poor in anything. We're only poor in the forms, in the effects, in the images. What we're really poor in is one thing alone, the substance from which the images are formed. And being rich in that one substance, we have all of the effects we thought we lacked. We're no longer poor in health, we're rich in health. We're no longer poor in finances, we're rich in finances. We're no longer poor in the things of this world because they are added unto us. But we must first take the step of realizing that poverty is never in things. That is the illusion of poverty. If you are poor in spirit, you are poor in all things. And so he made that his first beatitude. The moment you realize that you are poor only in spirit, you're on the path. For at that moment you know that as soon as I attain even a measure of the substance called spirit, in that moment I am enriched, and the substance being my possession, it will now form itself as all the things that I have need of. And the moment we know then that we are only poor in spirit, that is the moment we are ready to be blessed. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven, because they have the substance of heaven. And this then was a revelation to an unheeding world that this is a universe of spirit. And deeper down would follow the knowledge that if spirit is the substance of the universe, spirit is my substance. And so at the very same moment he was revealing spiritual identity. Your identity as spirit, the identity of your neighbor as spirit, the identity of the universe as spirit, and the identity of God as spirit. And clearly, if all is spirit, then God is the only spirit, the only one, the only being. And now, all in one fell swoop, he had shown us that there is one power in the universe. Only one. And all of the powers of lack and limitation and disease, even death itself, were imaginary powers existent only because man did not yet know that he was lacking in the one spiritual selfhood that he did not recognize on the earth. Having it, having his spiritual self restored to his consciousness, having a spiritual consciousness, man discovers himself to be the immortal self, the one, without opposite, possessing all of the spiritual qualities of spirit. And then the Bible is alive. All that spirit hath is thine, because thou art my spirit. Did you say you were lacking in these 50 things? They are all included and embodied in my spiritual selfhood. And then the journey has begun. Now we have this great strength of knowing that I have only one goal: the realization of my spiritual selfhood. Having it, I have all. And as this begins, as this conviction deepens, as nothing in this universe can stop you from the attainment of that which you know is self, you're faced with the first problem. What am I going to do with this fellow, this man of flesh? And it tells you to mourn for him. It tells you that if you wish to be Christed, you must mourn for the man of flesh that you thought you were. It tells you to lay aside the garment of mortality. It tells you to realize that man of flesh never was even living. He is a dead corpse. It tells you to mourn for the dead corpse that you called your human self. It tells you to lay aside the dead concepts, the dead beliefs, the dead ideas. It tells you to lay aside all of the beliefs of the counterfeit human mind. Yes, we were interested in being enriched spiritually, but we can only do it when we will lay aside the material self. We are being told to impersonalize life, to take off the persona, the mask of mortality, and to permit ourselves to accept, not on blind faith anymore, but on the assurance of the Master within, that there is a spiritual universe all around us in which perfection abounds without opposite. And so have we been touched sufficiently to serve this inner spirit, or do we wish to continue in mammon, seeking the physical possessions of the world? This is where we determine the second beatitude and its position in our life. Are we ready to mourn, to lay aside the false dead self? Are we ready to begin anew another life as a child again? A new beginning, a new dimension, a grander vision of what life should be. And if we answer in the affirmative, then we begin the third beatitude. We are meek, not to our fellow man at all. We are meek to the Father within. We are meek unto the Spirit. We are moving now as pilgrims. We have learned that there is an infinite spirit, a transcendental spirit, which individualizes as the Father within. And if the outer man will make an adjustment to permit that vital contact with the inner man, this infinite transcendental spirit will function where we stand in our living experience. And so we become receptive. We develop the listening ear. We seek the guidance of that Father within. We say, "Speak, Father. Thy servant heareth. I am a servant of the Most High. I listen for my Father's voice, the shepherd within." And as the Father guides, we become the outer fingertips of the infinite. We only move as we are moved. The outer becomes the visible expression of the inner. The mind is no longer on the throne. The soul is guiding. The soul is teaching. The soul is becoming the power that furnishes all that is needed in this experience. So we are lifted through this meekness to the spirit into higher realizations of self, and we come into that great area called righteousness. This is what we had hungered for and thirsted for. This was the pearl of great price for which we were willing to sell all that we possessed. Righteousness. But not my righteousness, not self-righteousness, not the righteousness of this human mind and body, but the righteousness of the Father within. The righteousness which says, "My thoughts, my guidance, my will in you is righteousness." And until you have opened yourself through meekness, through mourning, through the confession of spiritual poverty to my will in you, you do not rise to the level where you can be an outer expression of the infinite in all its glory. This righteousness is the righteousness that exceeds the righteousness of the Pharisees, of the scribes, of the church, of man whose breath is in his nostrils. For it is not a human righteousness. It is divinity expressing itself, pouring itself forth from the deepest recesses of your own soul. It is infinite guidance appearing locally. And thus you are in the right use of all the faculties that you have. In this righteousness, we feel the power of God. We feel the power of the Spirit. We can feel the doors open around us. We can feel invisible sunlight. We can hear invisible music, inaudible music. We can feel the power of the infinite. This righteousness is the beginning of the new dispensation. Instead of karmic law, instead of subservience to man, instead of subservience to the elements, instead of subservience to all of the visible lacks and limitations of the world, we break the law of karma. But it is really broken for us. The opposites diminish, dissolve, disappear. There is no hate, there is only love. There is no lack, there is only fulfillment. There is no injustice, there is only the law of divine justice. Because righteousness is now the only power functioning in us. We have transcended the opposites. You can tell when this is happening in you, because it takes you into the next beatitude. You find you have the quality of mercy. And the reason you do is because as you look out with righteousness, the will of the Father in you governing you, you look past the forms. You do not judge the effects, the images. You know now that forgiveness is not a human quality at all. Forgiveness is a divine self within, recognizing itself without everywhere. The divinity of your being looks out at your fellow neighbor and beholds the invisible Christ. That is your mercy. It is a recognition of the invisible self, the Son of God, everywhere. And so once more, we are blessed by this new higher vision. We are merciful, and unknown to us, it was only through this ability to rise to the level of divine forgiveness that we too could be forgiven, that we too could be made white as snow. For now we are judging no man, and we are not judged by man. The mercy we are extending to the world is measured back unto us, because we have sent out only the good, and only the good can return. All the bread we cast upon the waters at this level is love. Nothing can return to you except love, for that is the law. And soon we find we have no enemies, we have no debtors, we have no antagonisms. We are reaching that glorious place where the righteousness of the Father within, having purified us of the dross of human resentments, human antagonisms, human judgments, we are in conscious union with the Father. We are in the unconditioned universe. We are free. We have found the real freedom, the freedom of spiritual consciousness, which we could never find in a body or in a mind. And now we are a free, transparent channel for the infinite. In this level of purity, we are the pure in heart. There is no personal self intervening. There is no glass darkly. There is no thinker. There is only the Spirit expressing where you stand as your very being. This level, the pure at heart, is the Christing. This is the Christ consciousness. This is infinity, where you stand. Now we have discovered then in these six steps that Jesus was teaching the world that what they saw with a three-dimensional eye was not the creation of God. He was teaching them that all men on earth were in a state of cosmic hypnosis, accepting powers that did not exist, conditions that were unreal, living under a condition of karmic law, living under the belief of divine punishment. And in six steps, he delineated the path that he himself had already followed. Not his theories, but his tested, proven, dependable demonstration that if you begin with the realization that your only need is spirit, that all that exists is spirit, and if you consecrate your time and effort to the realization of spirit everywhere through putting off the old man, dedication to that spirit within, letting it dwell in you and you dwell in it until the moment of freedom from this cosmic mind, you would then be lifted to the place where the eye of you would lift all men unto you, where you could unsee that which human eyes declared, where you would become a witness of the Most High. And then finally, the Christing, the initiation the opening of the kingdom of heaven on earth to you. And still we're a bit short of the mark. We're untested. We have to still go through that testing period. And so he tells us, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And here is where you discover if this is for you or not. Judas couldn't make it. The acid test was too much for him. But when you have the ability to look at the persecutions of the world around you, the horrors, the corruption, the evil, and all that seems to be beyond the control of man, when you can also look at the subtle persuasions within yourself, those little invisible persecutors of your own mind, and can face all this with the knowledge that you cannot be moved from spiritual identity, which is the realization of omnipresent perfection, and that every problem that presents itself to you is nothing more than the acid test of your conviction, then you will know that you have touched the higher consciousness. You will know it was necessary, too, because the word in you must be sealed. You must pass through that acid test. In fact, he goes a step further. He says, rejoice. Rejoice when you are persecuted. Why? Because so persecuted they the prophets before you. That's how these men came into their highest state. Every persecution, every lack, every limitation, every form of adversity, however severe it appears to the naked eye, is cementing home for you, if you are ready, the realization that in the spiritual universe, these persecutions are pure mirage. If they're real to you, then you've got to go back to step number 1, 2, 3, and 4 and find out where there was a flaw in your understanding. When you follow them carefully, when you come to the 6th step, the 6th beatitude, poor at heart, pure in heart, you should be a perfect transparency, so that even the major catastrophes of this world are quickly seen for what they really are. Peace has no opposite. Love has no opposite. Eternality has no opposite. Immortality has no opposite. Abundance has no opposite. Every opposite, anything unlike God, is but a shadow of thought. And you need not remove that condition. You must simply come over that shadow of thought. Now, these Beatitudes represent the almost total message of Christ on earth. The rest of the Sermon on the Mount is a delineation of the meaning of these 6, 7, 8 cardinal points. To be sure, then, that you do not overlook this little area or that little area, he goes on and says, you have heard it said of old. And that means perhaps you have tried to live by the Ten Commandments. Perhaps you have tried to do what you call the right thing. But always, in spite of that, as long as you lived in a human mind, you lived in the human opposites. You could never extricate yourself from war and peace, from love and hate, from lack and abundance, good health and bad health. Always there had to be an up for a down, a black for a white, an in for an out, a high for a low. But now there is a subtle transmutation. The lower becomes the higher. The inner becomes the without. The divine becomes its own expression, and the shadows of imitation fade away. It is said that he went onto a mountain, but you know by now that the only mountain he went onto was the mountain of high consciousness. And he said, follow me up this mountain of high consciousness. Actually, this complete Sermon on the Mount was the ordination of his disciples. And to show that he was not intending it only for these 12, when he ordained them, when he gave them these divine principles, he spoke to the world. Others were present. He was demonstrating that this, though it be the consecration of my disciples, it is a universal message. It is for all who will follow me as my disciples in the future. All who will begin by renouncing all the false beliefs in poverty, and realizing there is only one poverty in all this world, the poverty of spirit. And then he revealed how from that wisdom we walk out of this world into my kingdom on earth. This was the message of infinite grace. It is called learning how to work without working. Learning how to let the life spirit effortlessly fulfill itself in and as you. That's what the butcher was really saying, who didn't have to sharpen his knife for 20 years. Now, we who have not found this area of grace are not practicing the message of Christ. Actually, Christianity has not been taught on this earth for some 1700 years. You see, Christianity, in its real essence, before it was organized, was a teaching about grace and truth. Man had been taken out of the karmic law and brought from karmic law to grace. And the teachers of Jesus went around in ones and twos explaining the message. At first they taught it to only Jews. They didn't realize themselves that he had taught a universal message. So the earliest teaching was to what they called Jewish Christians. And these fellows still thought it was a sect of Judaism. Paul and Peter eventually took it out of that, particularly Paul. But it was never called Christianity. It was simply a higher order of life that originated inside Judaism, then came out of Judaism, and finally was organized and called Christianity. At which point a very unusual thing happened. All that remained was the name. The teaching of grace and truth was thrown right out the window. The men who organized it had no knowledge of what it meant. And so they immediately put religion right back into old-fashioned Judaism and taught about a God of punishment. They took the old Judaic non-God and made it God. Grace was lost. Truth was lost. The words remained, but there was nobody to teach them or practice them. And as you come up to the 20th century, you find that for 1,700 years, the Beatitudes have been merely black print in a little book called the Bible. And people do what this woman told me they do. I said them this morning. I used to say them too. To do them, to live them, to be them. And then you see that poor in spirit branches out into seven more meanings. Once you have caught the idea that unless spirit flows through you, you're a branch cut off, you realize there is no place where you can stop that flow. The moment you stop it, you stop consciousness from being your God. There must be infinity flowing at all times, and so we are constantly poor in spirit. That is our greatest wealth. The ability to stay poor in spirit, to let the spirit flow in, through, and out, and consistently be open for the flow of more. There is no end to infinity, and it must flow through you without interruption. There is no place where you're satisfied. No place where you can say, now I am content. Now I can stop. You might just as well say, now I will stop living, for spirit is life itself. When we tune then to the Father within, we really mean that we are in contact with that infinite spirit which is individualized as our very being. The outer man and the inner man are one. I and the Father within are one. And the Father within is one with the infinite Father. And now we have conscious fulfillment of our mission on this earth. Now we can fulfill our purpose. Now we can glorify the Father. Now we can walk forth on the earth as the Son of God, as the light. We have all read these Beatitudes before. Now we're going to make them ours. For the rest of this book is really about the Beatitudes. The next 9 or 10 chapters are all about the Sermon on the Mount, which in itself is an elaboration of how we can pursue these 8 steps right up to a total rebirth. The new birth is actually the receptivity to the light of the Father within. It births itself. It takes you out of the sphere of reincarnation after reincarnation into the sphere of transition into the kingdom. Now, with that as a preliminary, let's just dwell for a moment in the silence and go through our Beatitudes within ourselves, applying them to ourselves, somewhat like this. As I receive the spiritual impulse from within, I am becoming enriched in the spirit. removes all responsibility on my part. It says, come unto me. No matter how you are laden, my yoke is easy. I am the Spirit, the Father within. And I am here. I am living. I am present. I am not a future heaven. I am now. Let go of that old fellow, that mortal mind. Don't try to think this out. Don't cling to yesterday. Don't cling to your beliefs. Don't be cautious. Don't be concerned. Let go and trust the spirit of your own being. Let that other fellow die. You will be comforted. Develop the inner ear now and listen at all times. Remember, the Father within is not far away. Right where you stand, I am. Closer than your own heartbeat, I am. I, in the midst of thee, am ready to take on the burden of your life completely. Be meek unto me. For I will lift you into the realm of righteousness. I will be your way, your wine and your water. I will appear as a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. I will appear as food on your table. I will look out through your eyes, and I will hear through your ears. I will be your pulse. I will be your fortress. I will be your sword. And I will be the love that pours through you into the world. Trust me. Lean on me. Lean not on thine own understanding. For I am come. And now look out at your fellow man and love him. Let me, through you, love him. For I will show you that only the Spirit of God surrounds you in all this world, no matter what your eyes may see. I will show you wholeness where the eye sees fractions. I will show you peace where the eye sees war. I will show you inner peace, a peace so deep that it will pass all mortal understanding. I am the peacemaker within. I show you how to lay aside the feelings of insecurity, of doubt, of anxiety, of fear. For I am the one power. When my presence in you is released, there is only peace. You fear nothing that the world can do. Your peace is deeper than the ocean and higher than the sky. Your peace is the knowledge that I and the Father are one self. And your peace can stand before a mountain and push the mountain into a sea. To your peace, nothing is impossible. Why is all this true? Because when the Spirit of the Lord is upon you, there is freedom, the only freedom that really is. Freedom from every seeming lack. But only through this Spirit that is upon you. How can we be persecuted now? Every form of persecution occurred to the mortal self. I, the Spirit, cannot be persecuted. And I, the Spirit, am your being, realized, attained, accepted. We're in the land of joy. Rejoice. There are no enemies in spirit. There are no bombs in spirit. There are no lacks and limitations in spirit. Unveil the true self, and you find why it is said that the kingdom is at hand. All this is the salting, the restoring of the Sabbath to the salt. Is there another way? You will find there is none. And if you waste years seeking another way, each way will lead you to the same place. You must find the spirit of your being. You must release yourself to it. And these 1700 years have shown us the folly of turning to human authorities, the folly of seeking a way through religion, through science, through philosophy, through government. There is no such way, because religion, science, government, and philosophy, they too must find that they are poor in spirit. Each must come to this conclusion to begin the birth of the real self. Science offers its cosmic toys. Religion offers its prattle about God. Government offers us this and finance offers us that. Everywhere we are given theories, ideas, concepts of the counterfeit mind of man, which rejects the illuminated, dependable demonstration of the Christ mind. And that Christ mind gave us the Beatitudes. It never said that this will all come true someday. It said it is true. It didn't say blessed will be. It said blessed are. It was speaking in the present tense, the eternal now tense, that when you have accepted poverty of spirit as your only sin, blessed are the poor in spirit. You have begun the pilgrimage. You're on the path. And once on the path, you cannot be taken away. As you go through the remaining lessons in this book, and as you review what you have done up to now, try to make that adjustment which sees that all you have to do is to begin at the right place and then slowly take each step until you have a coordinated inner program of knowing that unless I am now in contact with the inner spirit, this day is a human day. This day is a separated day. This day will be a fruitless day, for the human does not bear spiritual fruit. And then why waste that day and that month and that year and that lifetime? Learn from the era of 17 centuries that poverty of spirit is the only poverty in the universe, the only sin, the only crime, for it is the separation from your own being. That is where you begin. And with the right beginning, all else is assured. And so we have the way home to the Father's house that all of the religions of the world have walked by. Why they felt they could invent their own ways, I'll never know. But the human mind is that way. It knows so much better than God. And so we have all thought out our own individual schemes, and religions have given us their schemes. And each one has turned away from the very spirit itself, which says there is only one way. I am the way. I, spirit, am the way. I, spirit, am the identity of your being, unless you are I. There is no way for you, for the creature is not the way. The mind of the creature is not the way. Human authorities are not the way. And you can look through the Sermon on the Mount from the first word to the last, and conspicuously absent is all reference to the fact that in order to find the truth, you must go to God through religion, through the church, through the temple, that you must find some systematic theology. All of this is absent. He was taking us away from that to the kingdom of God within us. You know, and I know, that whoever has felt the kingdom of God within has sufficient proof that it is the way. We also learn that the way is sure. There's very little doubt in the way, because it's always proving itself, always blossoming forth with beautiful signs to tell you you're moving in the right direction. Until there's no self but I. The I that is the way is yourself. You're not a divided self. You're the one self. The one self which knows there's no one in this universe to persecute me. I am the one infinite self-expressing. And then all the mirages of the world, which call themselves powers, are frustrated because you are the way. Now are we the way? I think a little rest would be good for us. And then we'll see what the way has to tell us.